You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show, considered the hottest podcast in the universe. Now get ready for the heat. Here's Brian Callen.
I always say, look, start with guns, germs, and steel, and we can have a conversation. And at one point, we were together, and I said, do you think we could ever get Jared Diamond? And my friend, my colleague here, Hunter, said, why not? Worth a try. And so here you are, sir. Here you are, and thank you for joining us. It's very exciting.
You are welcome. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Great. You're not calling from Papua New Guinea, are you?
No, I'm calling from urban Los Angeles.
Well, you don't have to press your lips so you get dysentery. And your books are fascinating. We don't have to, guns, germs, and steel. When you win a Pulitzer Prize, you've gotten your share of, you know, accolades and stuff. Now you've gone on to write this book, The World Until Yesterday, which I thought was every bit as fascinating. And just for people, because, you know, part of this podcast is to get people to read the right stuff. You are really essentially saying there is much to be learned from traditional societies. We have reinvented the wheel to an extent as a modern people, but there is much to learn in the things we've left behind.
That's right. I would, in fact, say two things about them. One is that even if there were nothing to learn about them, which there is, they're just fascinating, and one could read them for enjoyment. Mm. The other thing is that, yes, there is a lot to learn from them. In effect, traditional societies are natural experiments in dealing with universal human problems, like how to bring up children and how to stay healthy and how to avoid dangers. The fact that we've got more potent bombs and denser populations than traditional peoples doesn't mean that we have better ways of bringing up children. And the reality is that I and friends of mine who've lived among traditional peoples have found that there is a lot that we can learn from them.
Well, one of the things that I think is very interesting about your books is that you actually break down in very simple terms the catalysts to why human beings organize, either as bands or tribes or, in fact, even states. For example, conflict resolution. I never even thought of it that way. But, you know, conflict resolution is very important. How do you deal with the accidental death of a child, for example, which you outline in your chapter? It was fascinating to me. There's this tendency, by the way, to just kind of a tangent for a second. There's a tendency for people like myself who haven't spent enough time. I grew up overseas. I lived in the developing world. But when you talk about something like Papua New Guinea, which already seems so exotic, and it is, the idea is, well, look, people die all the time, so the death of a child must be something people take in stride better than, say, someone in urban Los Angeles. Probably, though, that is not true. They're human beings. They feel the same exact kind of grief that we do, of course. And that's one of the things I think you highlight so well in Guns, Germs, and Steel. You highlight the differences. But I was fascinated with the ritual in how these tribes deal with stopping any kind of retribution and any kind of like sort of corrective violence in their part.
Yeah, they have to avoid collective violence because we in modern American societies, we don't go to much individual effort. Instead, there are police. If we were inclined to become violent, first of all, we know that the police are waiting, and so we don't do it. And secondly, if we do it, then the police come in and stop us from doing it. But in traditional societies where there are not police and there's not centralized government, then people have to prevent violence and resolve disputes by themselves, and they've got to do it because you're going to be living with those people for your whole lives. You can't afford to have someone angry at you who's going to be in your village for the next 60 years.
Hmm. And that's, I think, one of the things that really comes out in this book that you deal with so well is, of course, that, you know, the punitive aspects of a justice system are only a small part. There's also the emotional aspect, you know, a person being made whole in an emotional sense and being able to move on with their lives, which clearly traditional societies deal with much better than we do.
That's right. Here's an example. There are things that we as individuals can learn from traditional societies. For example, my wife and I do not have a salt shaker on the table in the kitchen. I've learned from traditional New Guineans who eat as much salt in 200 days as an American guzzles down in one day. And the result is that the New Guinean never, never gets stroke and hypertension. So my wife and I can decide for ourselves we're not going to have salt in the kitchen. But there are other things that require all of action by all of society to adopt. And for example, if I think that the American civil justice system has big drawbacks because it's concerned with right and wrong and punishment and deterrence, but it doesn't care at all about emotional reconciliation between a brother and sister in an inheritance dispute or a divorcing couple, if that's my opinion, I can't do anything about changing the justice system of the U.S. Instead, that has got to be a collective decision. And so the things that we can learn from traditional societies are partly individual lessons and partly lessons for society as a whole.
Where are you from, Professor, originally?
Originally, Boston, but my accent got messed up subsequently by living in Britain, Germany.
I'm an actor, man. I'm good with accents. And for that matter, Hunter's basically a linguist. And I'm going, where is he saying society? and I'm trying to figure out where that's from. And that sounds just a hybrid of lots of different influences there.
Yeah, my California wife says that she hears in me Boston and New York, where my parents came from, and Britain and Germany.
Right.
So I talk about Van Nuys, but my wife says it's Van Nuys.
Well, because you know why, Professor? Because it is Van Nuys. So I love that you said my California wife. That doesn't mean you have a New Guinea wife or anything. It doesn't mean you practice polygamy in New Guinea. But
no, I like monogamy.
Talk a little bit about monogamy and traditional societies. We live, I think, in this country, we live in a very puritanical country. We live in a very puritanical. One of the things that you find in this country, I think, is you're forgiven if you drink a little too much. You're forgiven if you come to work tired. You're forgiven for lots of lapses in self-control. You're not forgiven if you practice adultery. You're not forgiven if you practice polygamy. You're not forgiven if you're, a real philanderer, especially if you committed to one woman. And one of the things I think is fascinating about your case study is I had no idea Papua New Guinea, of the 7,000 languages, 1,000 are spoken in Papua New Guinea. The Highlanders and Lowlanders are so different in just the so many of their different practices. It really is a wonderful microcosm, I suppose, to study human beings in all their vast differences. There's so many different differences. But how do traditional societies? How have they all looked traditionally at monogamy?
That's a really good point to talk about now towards the beginning, because a simple answer is, traditional societies vary enormously with respect to monogamy, and that's one of the things that makes traditional societies so instructive in general. They vary a lot. They vary much more than do our modern state societies. Virtually all, the great majority of modern societies with governments today have laws about monogamy, and in other respects, in how we bring up children and what we do with old people. Modern societies, Japan, the United States, Israel, they're similar to each other. Once you've got government, all societies come out looking pretty much the same. But traditional societies are much more varied, and they're varied with respect to monogamy. There are traditional societies where monogamy is the rule. There are traditional societies where most men at least desire to become polygamous. The commonest,
Los Angeles. Like Los Angeles, but keep going. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll pass on that.
There are
traditional societies that are polyandrous. That's to say, where women have multiple husbands rather than vice versa.
Wow.
This illustrates the great diversity. The commonest pattern in traditional societies is that the society is nominally polygynous, meaning that it's acceptable and, in fact, it's desired for men to have multiple wives, but very few men succeed in achieving that goal. In a society that's called polygynous, really 90% of men are monogamous, have just one wife, and only a small number of men, particularly affluent or socially successful men, succeed in having multiple wives. And you might be interested in the stories of some New Guinea friends of mine about why it really is difficult to have multiple wives.
Yes, I am. And I can venture a guess. The amount of time I have to spend on keeping my one wife happy is I'm always tired. So
that's getting in that direction. Yeah. So reasons why it's why my New Guinea friends tell me that it's not so wonderful to have multiple wives. There are difficulties. Difficulty number one is that you got to provide food for all of them, which means that the man has got to clear gardens for five wives rather than one wife. Mm-hmm. Problem number one. Problem number two is, let's be frank about it, so what are you going to do about sexually satisfying multiple wives? One New Guinea friend of mine, who had in fact two wives, said that his solution was that he lived with each wife for 2 weeks, and then he went to the other wife.
Mm-hmm.
And because, you know, we had a frank relationship, I asked this man, so what do you want to do? What do you do if your other wife gets sexually needy during the 2 weeks when she's off? And he said, what I tell her is, wait your turn. That would not work in the United States.
No, it would not. No, it would not. That's amazing. Although, wouldn't you say that for the most part, and you've studied so many different cultures, do you think that monogamy is certainly more natural than it is unnatural? You hear a lot of people say, well, monogamy is not natural. Well, if you look at most societies, especially the way states are set up, people are, for the most part, monogamous. That may very well have to do with practical things like disease, the spread of disease, and what you just said, you know, just, you know, resources. I mean, resources are scarce for one man to have to provide for, you know, not just in food, but frankly in sperm, for God's sake, you know, whatever
and,
it is.
And also
and in energy.
And in terms of the needs and the constraints on child rearing in a state society. You know, I mean, the amount
right.
of energy that is required to raise a child nowadays.
And responsibility,
Would seem to be much greater than it would be in a traditional society, but that may not be true.
Yeah, Professor, do you think the reason for monogamy is more practical, or is there a natural nostalgia for it of some kind? I mean, it's a hard question maybe to answer, but
yeah, it's not a matter of natural nostalgia, but it certainly is a matter of natural something. If you just ask for the what is the fact, what's the empirical fact, never mind the theories, about most men in most traditional societies, the great majority of men traditionally around the world have been monogamous. If they desire, they may secretly or openly desire to be polygamous, but most of them can't bring it off. And reasons include the one that you just mentioned, that it's work for both women and for men to bring up children. A man may not breastfeed his children. I mean, one interesting recent discovery is that men are capable of breastfeeding under certain circumstances.
What? Is that true?
We'll get back to that.
Yeah, let's put a marker, and a big, big marker in that. I want to come back to that, but keep going.
That's right. We'll come back to my recommendations later. But as far as bringing up children is concerned, a man in a traditional society has got to protect those kids, and he's got to hunt for those kids, and he's got to clear gardens for those kids. So when you talk about practical considerations, in a traditional society, just as in a modern society, it's just difficult for a man to have multiple wives and to take care of the children resulting from those
mm-hmm.
multiple wives.
Mm-hmm. Talk to me a little bit about mythology. You've got 1,000 languages in Papua New Guinea. I'd imagine you have a large number of different mythologies and different religions. I'm always fascinated as to why, and I can give you probably some reasons, but, you know, the Judeo-Christian ethic has been here for really 5,000 years almost. And I'm always surprised and amazed at its resilience. And I'm speaking really of the three great religions, at least Judaism to begin with, and then the two religions that sprung from that, Christianity and finally Islam. Buddhism has its place, of course, and stuff. But you know, I think that the power of those religions have really to do with things like, well, we are all of the same moral worth. You matter as much as the next person, regardless of your skill set and your color and all that stuff. I mean, those were at least the ideals we're supposed to reach for, et cetera, et cetera. We don't have to go into that. But how different are the mythologies in Papua New Guinea?
A big difference right away is just to take your example about say, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. And we could throw in Hinduism and Buddhism as well.
Of course.
All of those are examples of what one can call an organized religion. They're religions that are transmitted. In the case of Judaism, transmitted for 3,000 years, Christianity for 2,000 years, Buddhism for 2,600 years. They're religions that are transmitted, and they have writing. They have sacred books that are transmitted by writing, and they're organized. Namely, there are, in the religion, there are priests, whatever you call them, priests, rabbis, ministers, and there are houses of worship. All Catholic churches anywhere in the world, you walk into them and they look approximately similar. They've got the same Bible. They have the same sorts of services. Again, Judaism, there are different branches of Judaism, but say Orthodox Judaism is similar in different parts of the world and it's recorded in writing. The big difference with traditional religions is that the religions are not organized. It's not the case that one village has one religion and that religion is shared with 35 other villages. Mm. It's that each group has what you could call its own religion. It does not proselytize as do many or most organized religions. And it's not transmitted in writing. There are not full-time priests or ministers or rabbis. So, in short, a major difference between religion traditionally and religion as we know it is that religion as we know it is organized, transmitted in writing, whereas traditional religions are not organized. They don't have standardized rituals, and they're not transmitted in writing.
You know, when I read Guns, Germs, and Steel, one of the things that struck me, and one of the great contributions to that book, is that you answer a question. You start with a question that was asked by somebody from Papua New Guinea, and that is really, why are some societies more developed than others? You do, the book is seminal. You do an amazing job, obviously, of arguing and proving that so much of it had to do with access to edible grasses, to domesticated animals that could be domesticated, to weather, to and most importantly, maybe sharing of ideas. If there's a river like there is in the two rivers in China that kind of bring ideas back and forth, and geography has a great deal to do with it. However, when you look at the physical differences between people, and they are vast. You know, if you talk to a geneticist, some medicines work really well on Northern Europeans. They don't work very well with Africans at all. So we are very different genetically. We had a guy, David Epstein, on the podcast recently who wrote the book The Sports Gene, who basically talks about how important hardware is. Your genetics are very important for whatever sport you choose. However, I think you do such a masterful job in Guns, Germs, and Steel in proving that the human mind, has universally as much potential as the next person. Whether you're from Papua New Guinea or you're from China, really it's a question of access to ideas, access to opportunity, and training. What does that say about, does that ever kind of awe you, the fact that we really are the same, even though we are physically so different, but our mental potential seems to be, and you've done such a good job of proving that, seems to be that, you know, whether you're black, whether you're from Papua New Guinea, whether you're an Aboriginal Australian, you have the potential to be anything that a Northern European is. It's just a question of the opportunities given to you. What does that say to you? Do you ever, as a science-minded guy, which I'm sure you are, does it ever kind of make you feel like there's a God? Does it awe you in that sense? I hope you're getting my question. I'm kind of...
Yeah, no, I get the question. I would use the word fascinate rather than awe. Mm. Namely, yes, it fascinates me that peoples in different parts of the world are in some respect so much the same, and in other respects they're so different. You began by talking about the differences between people. Yes, there are big differences between people, and they're particularly the visible differences. People differ in things that we can see. Namely, different peoples differ in skin color, hair color, height, form of face, form of hair, eye color. So there are those visible differences. There are also metabolic differences and biochemical differences. Africans and Southeast Asians have genes that provide resistance against malaria. Swedes and Northern Europeans don't have genes that provide resistance against malaria because there wasn't malaria in Sweden. Mm-hmm. So yes, there are those differences. But if one were to conclude from that people are different in lots of other respects, in other respects, people are surprisingly similar. What one can say is that people are basically similar. They differ externally in the parts that are exposed to the environment. They differ in resistance to disease and biochemistry. But there's no evidence of people differing in their brains around the world.
That blows my mind. And Hunter's passion is this subject. He's written a book called The Straight A Conspiracy about that, essentially that the worst idea is that people were born smart. That is a bad idea. In fact, it has so much to do with just opportunity, and your book does that. So, yeah.
And also, I mean, the beliefs that we have. I mean, I have to tell you, Professor Jared, whatever I'm supposed to call you.
We'll call him Professor Diamond.
Yeah.
Because he's earned it.
Yeah, I read Guns, Germs, and Steel my freshman year of college, and it changed my life. I mean, it really was like so emotionally impactful. Like Brian, I lived all over the world, and I think that, you know, we live in this very unfortunate period in our intellectual history when we look at the differences in outcomes between, you know, different groups of people from different places in the world, and we've been told that the narrative of race is broken, right? That you can't simply explain that in terms of, you know, people of different skin tones are smarter or less smart. But we haven't really been given a satisfying narrative, right, until Guns, Germs, and Steel to really understand why did the West get rich and why is so much of the rest of the world poor. And I mean,
it makes you wish that he'd written the book 200 years ago.
Yeah, and it makes you wish that everybody had read the book.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, you know, such a moment of catharsis for me. And I think in terms of the...
Was it a moment of catharsis for you, Professor?
It wasn't a moment because it just took so long.
Yeah, I was going to say.
When you
wrote the book overnight, sir, was it? You're right.
Not quite. I went to New Guinea for the first time in 1964. Yali, the New Guinean who asked me, why do you white people have all the cargo and we black people don't? He asked me that question in 1972. It wasn't until 1986 that I started getting ideas about how I would have answered Yali. And it wasn't until 1997 that I wrote the book. So there was not a flash of insight. There was long reading and learning about fascinating stuff such as origins of agriculture. Let me give you just one anecdote, because it's a nice anecdote that illustrates this fascination of New Guineans being so like each other and so unlike each other. The first tribe that I worked with in New Guinea was the Foray people in the highlands. Now, the highlands of New Guinea, people have been in the highlands for 46,000 years. The highlands were isolated from the coast. Highlanders didn't visit the coast.
Did you say 46,000? 46,000 years.
46,000 years is when people first came to New Guinea.
Wow.
And so highlanders have been there for a long time. They've been isolated for a long time. One might think then that there's been lots of time for them to end up very different from us, and in particular because there has been writing in the West for 5,000, about 200 years, and there's been writing in Europe for 4,000 years. You might guess that there would be genetic requirements to be able to write, and that New Guineans wouldn't have those requirements.
Mm.
Well, while I was on a trip to New Guinea about 10 years ago, I happened to be working in an oil camp, and I had a room in the oil camp where I was doing my bird studies. In the next room, there was a New Guinean working away at a computer. So just out of curiosity, I introduced myself. It turned out that he was from the Foray tribe, the tribe that I had first encountered in 1964.
The Highlanders.
A Highlander.
Yes.
And it turned out that he was the son of the first South Foray man who had learned to write. So you might imagine that after 46,000 years of isolation, it would take hundreds of years of evolution for New Guineans to acquire the genes that would let them write. But no, in come Europeans, they start to teach people to write, and immediately the father of this guy learns how to write. But on top of that, this guy, this foreign man, was sitting at his computer. He had learned how to operate a computer. I don't know how to turn a computer on. And there he was. God. He trained as an engineer. He was developing the water circulation plans for a small city in the Highlands. So there, in one generation, he has gone from non-literacy to computer literacy far beyond me, and he's an engineer devising waterwork systems. That just illustrates that the brain is there, and what's missing is an opportunity. You bring in the opportunity, and within a few weeks, someone starts to write.
Then now, so this is one of the greatest stories I've ever heard. Let me just put it out there. Listen. This is. I wish the world could hear that story. I'm going to tweet that story. I'm going to do whatever I can. Look. I mean, what does that say about evolution? What does that say about the origin of the species? What does that say about the descent of man? What does that say about Darwin? That feels to me. It feels to me like there's something else going on. It feels to me that if we did descend from apes, I'm willing to believe it. I believe in science. Science is awesome. There's got to be a lot of room for science. Is there something else going on there that we haven't touched on? Since it seems to me that the 46,000 years ago, Papua New Guineans, even though they were isolated, were born essentially with the same brains as Europeans. The Europeans came along, and they did everything from the Acropolis to Aeschylus to Shakespeare to Beethoven to Mozart, and the list goes on, and nuclear fusion, for God's sake. And all of a sudden, in one generation, we've got somebody who is performing up to par.
But that's because of how you understand intelligence. You understand intelligence as in there must be a specific modality for writing and one for math and all of that sort of stuff. Mm. But what we now know over the last 50 years is that the amazing thing about the human brain is its raw flexibility, and that it's equipped with certain very basic tools that enable almost anything to be possible. I mean, I think one of the things that I remember, I don't know whether it was in your book, but about reading about these Papua New Guinean Highlanders, and they developed this system of irrigation for their crops. And of course, the well-meaning Westerners come in and say, oh, there's a much, much better way to do it. And of course, the system is a disaster. It wipes out the entire mountainside, you know, and it turns out that while their system may have been less efficient, there was a reason why it was structured that way, because it was sustainable.
Mm.
Was that in one of your books, Professor?
Yes, it was. It's a wonderful story. So in the New Guinea Highlanders, they grow sweet potatoes. The environment is rather hilly, and they have irrigation ditches. And the irrigation ditches go around the hills along the contour line. So in comes an agricultural expert, and he looks at these irrigation ditches going around the contour line, and he's absolutely horrified. He says, "For heaven's sakes, you stupid primitive people! That wretched irrigation ditch, it ought to run downhill to drain the water quickly off the top of the hill. And so, put in your irrigation ditches vertically going downhill." So the people were awed by the agricultural expert, and they put in their irrigation ditches vertically going downhill. And as soon as the rains began next year, within a short time, not only the water, but most of the topsoil on top of the hill was down at the bottom of the hill, because this is an area with rainfall up to 700 inches per year, and you do not want an irrigation ditch that runs straight downhill, otherwise it's going to become a river and carry away your topsoil. Well,
carry
in 46,000 years, New Guineans have had the opportunity to figure that out.
Yeah, they had 46,000 years. You might want to listen to a culture that's been around there for that long. What do you question, in some ways, not the basic tenets of evolution, but it does seem like our brains started pretty perfectly, didn't they? I mean, I don't know.
I would say to that yes and no. There's so much that we don't understand about the human brain. I would say most of what the human brain does, we still don't understand. How do children learn language within a year or so? These very complicated languages, a baby starts with words, and within a short time it's coming out with grammar and prepositions and conjunctions. It's suspected that there are some genetic programs that help the baby learn grammar and language, but we understand them to a limited degree. The other side of it, though, is going back to one of the things that you said, is there something that surprises me about the human brain? The other part of the answer is no. The human brain is a multi-purpose instrument. It's not that the human brain had some genes for computers that were waiting for 6 million years unused until computers get invented in 1944. Instead, the human brain is a multi-purpose instrument, and the brain can learn how to operate computers, the brain can learn how to write, the brain will learn how to do new things that haven't been invented 25 years ago. My brain learned how to use slide rules, my son's brains learned how to use pocket calculators. The same brain that Cro-Magnons had 25,000 years ago and let them do cave paintings in Europe, that brain also lets them use computers today. So yes, the brain is a multi-purpose instrument.
Did we have the same brains as Cro-Magnons? Do we know that?
We don't know it. Well, we don't know it for sure. There's no way that we would know it. What one can say is that we've got DNA sequences from people of tens of thousands of years ago, and one can recognize differences between DNA today and DNA 10,000 years ago, that 10,000 years ago there were slightly larger teeth. Mm. Okay, our teeth today are smaller than 10,000 years ago. Big deal.
Yeah.
But there's no indication of changes in the genes for language between now and 10,000 years ago. 200,000 years ago, maybe yes, but 10,000 years ago, no. And I would expect that if we had a time machine and we could get one of those Cro-Magnons painting in Lascaux Cave 18,000 years ago and bring them onto the UCLA campus and dress them up in jeans and a Lacoste shirt, that Cro-Magnon would pass unnoticed and would be able to get A in my classes.
That's amazing. That's really amazing. I think I might start preaching intelligent design. I'm going to move to Kansas. but I mean, when I hear stories like that, I do understand sort of the religious point of view. I can understand where they go, wait a minute, hold on. Evolution is not explaining certain things. That
but
story
it does,
is a
Brian.
Classic.
The point is that, you know, you are a historian. Mm. So, you know, you understand change.
I'm not a historian, but I talk to historians.
Well, but you majored in history, and so yeah. You understand change on a certain time scale. Mm. The time scale on which evolution works is incredibly long,
yeah.
And it's incredibly slow, and it's also, it's how does that evolution happen? You know, one of the big things is it, people tend to think of it in terms of a gradual accumulation of mutations, right, and that these things sort of evolve, you know, slowly over time, but it may be much more what's called punctuated equilibrium, where, you know, there are these massive changes and then it's fairly stable for a long time. I mean, a lot of this stuff is debated and it's not understood, but the point is that what's breaking down when people talk about intelligent design is that the model they have of evolution doesn't work.
Right.
But that's, the problem is not evolution.
Yeah,
it's
obviously.
That they have a simplistic...
There's no question that evolution is a big part of science.
Brian, I just don't want you to get yourself in trouble here.
I'm just here to preach the power of Jesus. Professor, are you a religious man? Have you become more religious as you've gotten older? Are you less religious? What is all the study done to you as far as, has it changed the way you fundamentally think about everything?
No, I'm not a religious person, and if anything, I've got less religious. In my recent book, The World Until Yesterday, I have a chapter on the development of religion, and near the beginning of that chapter, I wrote a parable. Now, I wrote it myself, but I must say the parable then really got to me. I asked myself, what would happen if some intelligent creature from the Andromeda Nebula were able to visit Earth? This creature would have run around the universe, come across intelligent beings in all sorts of galaxies, and eventually, after visiting the intelligent blobs and plants and stuff elsewhere, the creature comes to Earth. On Earth, the creature discovers that there's this strange species called humans, which has a high opinion of itself. The humans believe that the whole universe was created by something that then proceeded to create humans in their own image. And nevertheless, different humans have different views and kill each other over different views of what this remarkable creature had. Now, the visitor from the Andromeda galaxy right away knows this is nonsense because the visitor has run around the universe and he knows that humans are not a particularly impressive species. There are much more intelligent species elsewhere. Surely, if there is an advanced being that created the universe, that advanced being is not going to be similar to this pretty wretched species on planet Earth, humans. And therefore, the visitor asks, so why is it that religion, which is patently a delusion, why is it then that religion evolved and it's found in all human societies? It must be doing some good. And so my chapter on religion asks, what are the reasons that religion developed among humans? What good does religion do, with the result that essentially all human societies are religious? Because if it didn't do good, atheists would have taken over the world.
Yeah, well, you answer that question well in the chapter, too. I mean, in that, look, anybody who has children, you know, dealing with the death of a child or dealing with the things that you can't explain, when you're alone and scared and hungry and you know, you don't know, you think that the maker's at the door, living, I'm sure, where the average life expectancy in Papua New Guinea is, you know, people 60 years old is very old. And you tell a story when you showed up when you were 46 and they had a teenage boy have to follow you around to help you because you were half dead. I mean, that's going to make you, it's pretty easy to be in some ways an atheist when you've got plenty to eat and there's and you're very comfortable. I would imagine that, you know, it's that old saying, there are no atheists in a foxhole. Your environment is going to, when you can't explain your environment, when it's very harsh and overwhelming, when you feel like a sort of a plaything, a puppet in this vast chaos, it seems to be that human beings need something to think about. There's got to be a purpose. There's got to be something at the end of this tunnel, at the end of this suffering. All of this work is not for naught, and et cetera, right? I mean,
that's right. That's one of the reasons. It's one of about seven reasons why religion is so widespread. Just to take the reason you've mentioned, the thought of one's child dying. Thank God it hasn't happened to me, but I have plenty of friends whose children did die, and it's unbearable. I don't know how people go through their lives with it, and I can see that someone whose child has died or whose spouse has died, the belief that you're eventually going to some place where you re-encounter your dead child, the alternative is unbearable, the alternative of never encountering your dead child again, that's one reason why religion is so powerful. But still another reason is that today we've got science to explain why the sky is blue and why the sun appears to rise. But thousands of years ago, before there was science, New Guineans ask why the sun rises, just as did the ancient Greeks. The ancient Greeks, some of them at least, figured out the answer. And Copernicus and Tycho Brahe figured out the answer. But if you don't have modern astronomy, you still see that the sun moves across the sky. It cries out for explanation. It happens every day. And therefore, you got to come up with some explanation. In the absence of science, the traditional explanations were what we call religion. Now we have science, and science has gradually encroached on religion so that the majority of Americans don't invoke God to explain why the sun moves across the sky. Most Americans would not, like the ancient Greeks, say that the sun is loaded into a chariot pulled by Apollo each morning.
Well, so, they would be wrong, but keep going. Yeah, I know what you mean, yeah.
We can continue that discussion.
Yeah. To go back to also what you said earlier about, you know, when you talk about the great organized religions, I mean, that's, you know, and you do talk about that as a reason, too. So much of what religion does is it binds people into very, very large groups. It's an effective force for that. And I mean, I don't know if you've read Darwin's Cathedral.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, and it's an excellent book. And I mean, does such a good job of making the case for that also as one of the functions of religion is that it takes people beyond the group of 150 or so and can bind them into a mass movement of millions or hundreds of millions.
It also provides inspiration, doesn't it? Doesn't it, Professor? I mean, it provides inspiration. It feels like this idea that there's something bigger than me that I'm working for here.
Yes, yeah, right away. So we've now got at least four different functions, if you want to call them, of religion. As you said, religion binds people into groups. It provides something that you share with other people. I have a good friend who would probably say, I'm not sure if there's a God. I don't know if I believe in God. But she's nevertheless religious. She goes to church every week because her religion, her church, is a focus of her social life. That's something that religion provides. And then, as you say, religion also provides inspiration, either inspiration to provide a meaning for life or inspiration to enable you to go on after your child has been killed, or inspiration to convince you to go risk your life fighting against other people who would like to conquer your country. Why should you give your life? Well, religion is has provided reasons for people to give their lives, both to defend themselves and their families, and also, unfortunately, to go kill other people and conquer other lands.
I wonder what our movies and what our mythology, what our entertainment business would be like, what our story, the anatomy of our stories would be without those motifs, without that mythology, without that inspiration. I dare say it wouldn't be as fun and interesting a world to live in. We just had Lawrence Krauss on, who's going to be dropping soon on the podcast, who's a theoretical physicist who would probably chew my head off because he's such a militant atheist. And I didn't really grow up with much religion, but, you know, so much of what inspires us and what we watch and our heroes, people like Gandhi and Martin Luther King, those people were doing something because they really believed they were being guided by a larger, more benevolent force. They really believed they were put on the earth for a reason, and it wasn't a mathematical accident. It wasn't some evolutionary, biological sort of happenstance. No. In fact, they were put on this earth for one reason. That was to dedicate their lives and die, if need be, for a greater cause than themselves. And Nelson Mandela went down as, you know, I mean, all they talked about was the speech he made, which was, I am willing to die if necessary for these ideals by which I live. That, as a man who studied all these different cultures, that to me represents human beings at their best. Our heroes are those people that were willing to sacrifice their very appetites, their flesh and blood. Sir Thomas More, when he wouldn't renounce the Catholic Church, for example. These are the great heroes of our mythology, of our stories. And I dare say that's probably the case in all cultures across the globe. Would you agree with that?
That's a very interesting point. There are two things that I'd say to that. Would I agree with it? Only partly. in traditional societies, small-scale societies, I'm not aware of any small-scale society in which someone would give his or her life for an idea, for a religious idea. That's something that came in only with the development of organized religions and larger societies. Mm. In a larger society, you need ideas to enable people to get along with each other, to get along with strangers, not to attack strangers. And those ideas that make state government and living in large populations possible, those ideas, at least initially, were religious ideas, which provide reasons why you shouldn't go out there and kill the first stranger that you see. The other point that I'd like to respond to is your comment about bringing out the best in us. And yes, religion does bring out the best in us, and you've cited examples, Mandela, Martin Luther King. Religion, as you know, also brings out the worst in us. The biggest slaughters in human history have been carried out in the name of religion. So religion is a strong motivating force, both for good and, sadly, sometimes for evil.
But that's also the nature of what religion does. And, you know, I mean, David Sloan Wilson in Darwin's Cathedral, Jonathan Haidt in The Happiness Hypothesis really lay this out, which is religion elevates you out of yourself and makes you part of that larger unthinking unit. and unthinkingly, you know, without thinking of the consequences of how you will suffer, you know, you may be motivated to do something great and uplifting if your principles are in the right place, but unthinkingly, you may also be motivated to do something utterly evil.
I have a different point of view. I think that for the most part, if you look at the big, you know, if you look at Mao Zedong and Stalin and Hitler,
yeah, but those
and
are
Genghis
religions
Khan
too.
And Genghis Khan, they were not religions; they were, in fact, philosophies. There is a difference: one based in reason, one really based in the notion, "Let's kill 20 million people today for the betterment of humanity, and tomorrow for a billion people tomorrow." That was that was a mathematical and reasonable and very coldly calculated idea. Yes, the Inquisition. Yes, the Islamic Crusades and things. Killed a lot of people, but I actually think that that might have been just the work of sociopaths who were hijacking religion as a reason to do so. I think that religion in that sense, and I'm not a religious guy, but I think religion and organized religion in that sense gets a bad rap. Of course, there is the Book of Deuteronomy, and I think you talk about that in your book as well. I mean, there is the, you wouldn't want to hang out with the Israelites. I mean, the Book of Joshua, which you talk about. I mean, Joshua basically put to death everybody, including the animals, in all 400 cities, because they were non-believers. His God was a wrathful God. So you probably wouldn't want to hang out with the ancient Israelites. I guess I'm kind of making your point for you around the way. I don't know. Human beings are murderous.
Yeah, the ancient Israelites did not have a monopoly on slaughter, and slaughter is not something that only sociopaths do. Mm. When the first Spanish explorers came to the New World, or when British explorers came to North America or came to Australia, it wasn't just the odd sociopath who killed Indians. The average Joe Blow killed Indians and regarded them as people that don't have rights.
Mm. Right.
If we're going to say that Stalin or Mao was, you know, an entirely rational, calculating figure, or whether, you know, you're talking about the Crusades, either way, whether it's driven by religion or whether it's driven by reason, in both cases, the problem is a breakdown in empathy. Right, that's the real problem when you stop seeing the other in yourself
blind,
and the other.
And a blind belief system.
That's right. And I think that's what, you know, part of what's so great about, you know, The World Until Yesterday and Guns, Germs, and Steel and Collapse is all of your work really seems to draw together that theme of empathy and a reconciliation between the different parts of humanity, the different periods of history, and just understanding that fundamentally, yes, our circumstances may be different, but we're really basically in the ways that really matter in terms of our feelings, our desires, our drives, we're basically the same.
That's one of the things that I learned soonest in New Guinea. When I went out to New Guinea in 1964, having no idea what I would encounter there, I knew that these people were exotic in the sense that they had stone tools and they didn't have writing. I didn't know what they were going to be like emotionally, and I discovered pretty quickly, I found that New Guineans laughed at the same things that I found funny, and they got scared at the same things that scared me, and they cried at the same things that made me cry. So emotionally, people are people. Now, emotionally, of course, people can be brought up differently, but potentially, people have the same range of emotions around the world.
Mm-hmm. You have that amazing, amazing picture in your book about the I think it was 1931 when the first time the New Guineans had seen white people, and this Australian was walking up to him with a hat and clothing, and he was crying. He was so terrified.
That's right. That's something that I've seen firsthand myself. Fortunately, I've never made first contact with a New Guinea tribe. It's absolutely terrifying and dangerous. But there are individual New Guineans with whom I've made first contact. And I recall an occasion when I was in a remote mountain village in Indonesian New Guinea, where the adults had been out to the coast and had seen Europeans. But there was this baby, year and a half, 2 years old, being held by its mother. And so the baby had its back. I came in there, the baby had its back to me. The baby was laughing and playing with its mother, and I could hear the baby laughing and smiling and cooing. And then the baby turned around and looked at me, and within a fraction of a second, the baby's face turned from smile and laughter to an expression of absolute horror at seeing his first white person.
Wow.
And then the baby started howling in terror. That was first contact.
Wow.
That says a lot about human beings and how we react to things that are new and things that we don't understand. It is in our genes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's one of the things that I also loved is just the degree to which so much of the warfare that you find in places like Papua New Guinea is mostly intra-tribal rather than inter-tribal. It's a lot of fighting amongst ourselves rather than fighting amongst different groups.
That's right. Yeah. It is true that among New Guinea groups, people have to deal with neighbors, and sometimes they end up fighting with neighbors. They're as likely to fight with neighbors if the neighbors speak their own language as if the neighbors speak different languages. And so, for example, one of the chapters in my book, I think chapter three of The World Until Yesterday, is about the Danai people, D-A-N-I, the largest language group in Indonesian New Guinea. There are about 150,000 of them, and traditionally there was lots of fighting among the Danai. The Danai were surrounded by other Danai, and all the fighting was Danai fighting against other Danai.
What did you go to Papua New Guinea for in the first place? Were you going there? You were a geologist. Were you going there to study birds?
Two things. I went there to study birds because New Guinea has the world's most beautiful and interesting birds, the Birds of Paradise and Bowerbirds. And I went there for adventure. This was 1964. I was unmarried, craving adventure, young and ignorant.
Wow.
And at that time, New Guinea was the wildest, most adventurous part of the world.
You're a very smart man, but you're kind of a badass, I have to say. I wouldn't do that. That's, you know, I hang out with fighters, and that's a pretty badass thing to do, man.
To
that's,
go to a land of cannibalism, that is, you
and
know.
That was when there were cannibals still, weren't there?
That's right, but there are rules about who you eat, and when I went to New Guinea, there was still there had been cannibalism going on recently. There were two sorts of people who got eaten. You ate your own dead relatives in order to
delicious.
Show them
delicious.
One of my New Guineans, the second year that I was there, he quit his job with me because his prospective son-in-law, the man who was engaged to his daughter, had just died, and he was expected and entitled to take part in the funeral feast and eat his dead son-in-law. So you eat your own dead relatives, and also you may eat your tribal enemies whom you've killed in war, but I was neither a dead relative nor was I a traditional enemy of any New Guinea.
Wow.
So I never felt at risk of being
eaten. What would they eat? What part of the body would they eat, and how would they prepare it?
They eat the whole body, and as for how they prepare it, I'm not sure if you want the answer.
I do want the answer.
Okay.
I want to get to breastfeeding. We have to remember that. Just keep go ahead. How do they prepare the body?
There are two sorts of ways to prepare the body, which involve either cooking or not cooking. If you cook the body, you can cook it in the same ways that you would cook a pig. You boil it, you put it in a fire pit. The alternative is not to cook the body, and this goes on in the hot tropical lowlands. One of the areas where I worked, if someone died, the people put the body on a raised platform with holes and slats at the bottom. And underneath, you asked for this, I'm telling you.
I'm ready.
The holes, they put a pail, and in the hot tropical sun, the body would liquefy and maggots would grow in the body and the flesh would gradually liquefy and the juices would drip off the body into the pail. And then I'm told, I never saw this happening, but I was told that people would dip their sweet potatoes into the juices that dripped off into the pail. You may now get a sense for why, if I had been offered the opportunity, I would not have participated in cannibalism.
I was going to say, and I'm amazed that people didn't die of disease, doesn't that? That seems
they do.
Kuru. First group that I work with, the foray, the commonest cause of death among the foray while I was there was a disease called Kuru, which is basically mad cow disease, Creutzfeldt-Jakob, that had become established and spread through cannibalism.
From eating human brains and other human neural tissue.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, God.
And they also call Kuru laughing sickness, don't they?
Yes, because it involves the early stages involve a breakdown of central nervous system control, so people have difficulty walking, but they also have difficulty refraining from laughter.
God, it's so incredible.
Yeah,
to me.
It's amazing.
That is amazing.
What's really amazing to me is that, you know, Emily Post did not deal with the rules of eating your other people. Like, no. There's that chapter is just not in there.
Well, it's a hard thing to even, you know, make sense of. It's so crazy. Although I know the Native Americans practice cannibalism in certain parts of this country.
Lots of peoples all over the world have practiced cannibalism.
Yeah.
And you make people desperate enough. I mean, look at the Ukraine in the 1930s. I mean,
yeah. But if you're starving, but a lot of societies that were not starving necessarily, but I guess protein, you know, if anybody's been hunting, I always talk about this. If you ever gutted a deer and chopped it up, you can see why hunter-gatherers who hunt and that intimate process of killing an animal and quartering the animal and skinning the animal and eating the animal, you can understand why it's so easy to kill a human being once you get very familiar with killing an animal. There's not a lot of difference between a human being's rib cage and innards to a deer's, believe it or not. I mean, the deer has fur and thicker skin, but a knife does the job very easily.
Once you kill the human being, though, yes, you can kill a human being. I was going to say you can kill a human being as easily as you can kill a deer, but that's not true, and that's important. One of the reasons that cannibalism is not more widespread than it actually is that humans are the most dangerous animal. Mm. It's easier to kill any animal. It's easier to kill an elephant than another human. Mm. So there are not societies that we know of that made a practice of hunting people for food. Mm-hmm. Just too dangerous.
And there's also, there's the emotional component as well. I mean, you know, one of the things we do know about the brain is there are large parts of our brains are devoted to recognizing human faces, and it's difficult to kill a human being on an emotional level.
Yeah, I would imagine. Is that true, Professor?
So I'm told.
Yes.
Whatever my fantasies may be.
Yeah. Listen.
I've never come close to acting on my
own. That's it. But what? You did see or know of a lot of murder that went on between tribes and even within tribes in Papua New Guinea. Very violent place. I mean, you're more likely to die of, in hunter-gatherer societies, you're way more likely to die of violence from another man or another person than you are other things, right?
What one can say is that violence is one of the three or four common causes of death in traditional societies. Violence, but also infectious disease because they don't have antibiotics, and starvation because they don't have supermarkets, and then environmental accidents like drowning in rivers because we've tamed our environment and they haven't. But it is true that the chances of dying a violent death are higher in traditional societies than modern state-level society, for the obvious reason that we have police and we have the army and we have law courts and they don't.
Yeah, but you know, when the jungles of Papua New Guinea, first of all, how big is this area that we're talking about if you include Indonesia, Papua New Guinea? How big is it?
A few hundred thousand square miles, roughly the size of California.
It's a huge area, but the jungles are not, it's a very dangerous jungle, isn't it? I mean, you've got crocodiles, you've got wild pigs, you've got spiders and scorpions and poisonous snakes, not to mention you can get tropical ulcers if you just get a scratch and things. But what is the most dangerous animal in the forest?
Well, compared to Africa, New Guinea forest is actually an undangerous place. Hmm. I walk around routinely unarmed, alone in New Guinea forest. The crocodiles, they're confined to the lowlands, and of course only swampy areas of the lowlands. Wild pigs, yes, there are wild pigs, but there's only one occasion when I've been threatened by a wild pig. The dangerous animals there are insects, actually. They're not big animals. There's no big animal that would be a danger.
No cats, no lions, no leopards.
No lions, no leopards. The biggest mammal is tree kangaroos. Tree kangaroos can weigh up to maybe 70 pounds, but tree kangaroos, they're herbivores. They're not going to attack you. Mm. Most dangerous animals are, in fact, insects and wasps. I remember being with a New Guinean going around the forest. He pointed out an ant mound and said, "Watch out, if you get into that mound, they'll kill you."
Wow.
Really?
Yeah. And also the biggest spider that I ever saw, I still have nightmares about this, was a spider, let me just pull out a ruler now, a spider whose body was about 8 inches in diameter.
Oh, God. That's not
That's
cool.
That's amazing.
Something That's
really
not
to
cool.
give you
Ugh.
Nightmares.
Yeah, I don't like that at all.
No.
And what about scorpions? They have scorpions and poisonous snakes as well,
Oh, yes,
right?
they're scorpions. So whenever you put your shoes, whenever you put your boots on in the morning, the first thing you do is take your boots and shake them out to shake out any scorpion that was in your boots. There's a friend of mine from a German family who actually grew up in New Guinea, and she didn't move back to Germany and Switzerland until she was a teenager. She has not been able to shake the habit. So 20 years later, when she gets up, the first thing she does is still to shake out her shoes,
yeah.
shake out the scorpions.
Wow.
I get it.
Yeah.
I understand that. I don't want scorpions on my feet. That's not a good time.
No.
It only takes you one lesson of yeah, I had a lesson once. I in the morning I was putting on my boots and I reached in the dark to pull up my boots and I felt a stinging. I never saw what caused the stinging, but the stinging was on my ring finger, the fourth finger of my left hand, which has my wedding ring, and I realized with horror that my finger was swelling up. I realized it and I wondered, am I too late? Have I realized it? Is it too late to get my wedding ring off before my finger swells and it becomes a tourniquet? And thank God, I was able to get my wedding ring off and my finger kept swelling.
Oh,
so I was able to wait until the finger went down again. I don't know what it was that was in my boot, but it's just a warning not only to shake out your boot, but not just to reach your hand into your boot in the dark.
Wow.
Take a look at what's there first.
Before Brian returns us to male breastfeeding, the one thing that I think is so important for listeners is, you know, would you just tell us how, you know, this work of your life has changed what you believe about race and the very idea of race, which is obviously for an American audience, that's something that's so important. And, you know, what is your research and what do your books say about that?
Sure. Several things to say about. First of all, there's the obvious fact that people from different parts of the world look different. They look different in their skin color, they look different in their eye color, they look different in their hair color. That's the first thing. Second thing is that you can then use those differences to classify people. If you classify people, though, they don't fall into neat pigeonholes. It's not that there are 1 billion people with dark skins and 1 billion people with white skins and nobody in between. It's that populations with dark skins grade indiscernibly into populations with paler skins. And so as you start out in Northern Europe and you go into Southern Europe, people are darker, and you go into Northern Africa, people are still darker, and you go into Central Africa, people are darker yet. Therefore, races as clean divisions between people, they don't exist. But nevertheless, you can't go to the opposite extreme and say that people look the same everywhere, because everybody knows that they don't look the same everywhere.
And then, of course, what does, you know, does race have anything to do with human potential?
There are lots of people lots of racists who put a lot of effort into trying to establish that race has something to do with human potential, and they haven't come up with any evidence yet.
Amen.
Amen.
Evidence against it are that South Foray man in the next room, the son of the first person who learned to write, who ended up at a computer devising waterworks systems, but I couldn't turn on his computer.
Yeah. Why is there such a difference? Is the highlands very hard to get to? Is that why they were so isolated?
Yes, the lowlands are near the coast. If a ship lands, Europeans on the coast, and they start walking, they can certainly walk a few miles into the lowlands, whereas the highlands of New Guinea, although Europeans started prowling around the coast of New Guinea already in the 1500s, it wasn't until 1931 that they got into the densely populated valleys of eastern New Guinea. It wasn't until 1938 that they got into the densely populated valleys of western New Guinea, and it's because you might say, well, the highlands just 80 miles from the coast. Well, in New Guinea, 80 miles. I've been I just came back recently from a mountain range in New Guinea, where in 1983 I tried to walk up to the highest mountain from the coast. And after 17 days, I had gotten 11 miles. It was clear that I was not going to get there. But there was a British expedition in 1908 that tried to reach the highlands from the coast. And after a year and a half, they had gotten 80 miles. And so they gave up and went back home.
Unbelievable. What a trip. Unbelievable. Let's get to male breastfeeding.
All right. So male breastfeeding. In practice, breastfeeding is done by women. Does this mean that men are incapable of breastfeeding? No, men are capable of producing milk in small amounts, particularly under some circumstances. The best established circumstance for men producing milk is that when the concentration camps were opened at the end of World War II, and starving people from the concentration camps were then fed, the refed, starved men often began producing milk. There's something about starvation, the hormonal changes, and then the subsequent refeeding, those subsequent hormonal changes that result, at least transiently, in milk production. But it is the case that men, given stimulation such as mechanical stimulation, are capable of producing small quantities of milk. I'll have to tell you a story there, and that is that I have a friend. He's a man. He's about 6'2". He's husky, but there's something about him that his beard is rather sparse. And say he's American, so he was in an Australian pub, and he enjoys teasing people. So in this Australian pub, in a loud voice, he began telling stories about how we Americans are so egalitarian. And he then said that when my wife had a baby, was breastfeeding the baby, I decided, egalitarian, I'm going to share the duties. And so I took some hormones and I did some mechanical stimulation, and I was able to breastfeed my kids along with my wife. Well, the Australians in the pub were falling over themselves with embarrassment and being grossed out.
Sure. Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Well, that's a loud American. That's what you call a loud, big-titted American, ladies and gentlemen. Professor Diamond, I got to tell you, man, that story and the other story have changed my life well forever. I might even just never do a podcast again.
Bam, because, drop the mic.
Yeah, we're not, exactly. We're not going to top this. It's amazing. I consider it a privilege to talk to you, and I really appreciate, and I know Hunter appreciates you taking the time to speak to us. Your work is seminal. You're 75, I believe, and you're still turning out, you know, work like this that's changing minds and inspiring people like us. So I thank you. I thank you for who you are, and I just I can't thank you enough for being on the Brian Callen Hunter Motch show here.
I thank you for a lively conversation.
Listen, I can only offer one thing. I know you live in L.A. I'm always doing stand-up when I'm not on the road. I'm at the Laugh Factory at the Comedy Store. If you ever want to come out and laugh your ass off, you'll learn nothing, but I promise you I'll make you laugh.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and I hope I've made you laugh, too.
Yeah, you are. Absolutely. You've done more than that, my friend. You've done more than that, sir. And if you ever are in town, you're with your family, you let me know, and I'll lay out the red carpet. You come out and see me, and I'll make you laugh.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for everything.
Thank you, sir.
And keep doing what you do, sir. We'll thank you. We'll see you. I hope to see you soon someday.
Thank you. Take care of yourselves.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Jared Diamond, ladies and gentlemen. Jared Diamond.
Drop the mic.
Dude,
mean, that it doesn't get me better
man.
Than that. That
come
is
come on,
like,
man.
Yeah.
Breastfeeding, scorpions, fucking snakes, 46,000 years, and they're just the same. That's a life-changing. I just feel so lucky to be able to have a conversation like that.
Absolutely.
This is what it's about. Just I never thought I'd be in a position like this.
To
I don't know how many people are listening to our podcast, but I just never thought I'd be this lucky to have conversations like this. I'm learning something every single time.
And it's such a privilege. And I think that's what's so cool is, you know, when you talk to a guy like Jared Diamond, like, he's such a vaunted figure.
Yeah.
But listen, he, in the same way that, you know, he meets those Papua New Guineans and finds that emotionally they're just the same, he's just the same. He likes to talk about male breastfeeding.
Human being, ladies and gentlemen.
The snakes and all of that
sort of
stuff.
You know, we know what we proved on this podcast?
What?
That racism is bullshit.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's a lie.
That's right.
So and there we have it.
It all comes back to The Muppets in Manhattan, one of my favorite movies. And there's a line in there.
You're such a nerd. Keep going, you fucking nerd. Keep going.
But there's the Greek restaurant owner, and he like offers his advice about life. And he says, peoples is peoples, you know? And that really is sort of...
I like it. Yeah. On that note, and that's a terrible Greek accent.
Yeah, well, fine. So thank you.
Peoples is peoples.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, there it is. Bye-bye.
Jared Diamond.
Oh, wait. I'll be in when is this dropping? I don't know.
Who the hell knows?
Go to BrianCallen.com. I'm doing stand-up. Come out and see me.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show. Be sure to visit BrianCallen.com for information about this episode as well as past and future episodes. You can follow Brian on Twitter at Brian Callen and like him on Facebook. Go to Facebook.com/BrianCallenComedy. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.